Really?
Yeah.
And the chicken dance, what's your view on that?
No.
That was ridiculous. I was forced to do that at one of the last weddings I went to.
Were you?
Yeah. That was in Hoboken. I guess I'm lucky to not have to go to that many weddings.
All right, Tom and Elise, what's the worst group of people in America?
The worst group of people in America are the people that are obsessed with Christmas.
Christmas fanatics.
Yes.
Now, do you mean like people who like over-decorate or the Warren Christmas people, or how do you mean that?
They're
too many
like
presents?
They're waiting all year for Christmas, and they have Christmas decorations all year round.
The people have their Christmas decorations up now.
Exactly.
Yeah.
For the entire year.
Where was I thinking? Oh, there used to be Fountains of Wayne used to have like Christmas decorations all year round.
Where?
Fountains of Wayne. It's out in Wayne, New Jersey. There's a band named after them. You may have heard of them.
No, I haven't.
There's a place that sold fountains, but they also sold Christmas decorations all year round, in addition to fountains. Fountains being seasonal.
Well, next to my house, there's a store with all year round, they sell Christmas stuff, and people buy them all year round. It's really annoying. I can see them right now from my window. It's terrible.
Now, I've never been to Puerto Rico. I assume it does not snow there. You never get a white Christmas?
No. So, it's heat all year round. It's terrible.
So people still have the whole Santa snow reindeer thing, even though you're in a tropical...
Oh, they do in Miami.
They do,
okay,
and they put it on their rooftops and everything.
Yeah, they put snowmen in their lawns.
Okay,
and it's like 80
I grew
degrees.
Up in Arizona, just asking. Well, but sometimes people will put, like, you know, a cowboy hat on Santa in Arizona, that sort of thing. Make regional adaptations.
No, it's American decorations in the tropics. Terrible. And sometimes they put fake snow on their lawns and everything.
Fake snow in Puerto Rico.
Yes.
Okay,
it was
Tom.
The major who did that brought fake snow so the kids would play around.
Do fake sledding?
Oh, I did that when I was little. It was fun.
You played in the fake snow?
Yeah. They brought it, like, in the community we lived in. All right, thanks for calling, Tom and Elise.
Okay,
have a good one.
I remember someone bringing real snow to Phoenix, Arizona. It didn't last very long, of course.
Should we go through my list?
Yes, let's review. Oh, it's almost the end of the show.
Dale said Americans are the worst group of people in America.
And how did that make you feel as
Ben
an American?
Ben Drinken says people who have dogs and compare it to having kids.
Mm-hmm.
Charles says internet trolls, which I think was a good one.
Dogs don't talk back.
And that's it.
Really? Those are your top three?
So far.
So far?
You don't like any of them?
Well, we don't have a lot of time for. We have time for like maybe one or two more calls.
I think so far it's Charles, but we'll see.
Charles with
FMU,
the what again?
FMU, you're on the radio.
Hello.
Hi.
Mark on Route 3, driving in New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
Listen, Andy, I know you're from New Jersey, right? Are you living in New Jersey?
I live in New Jersey, yes. I'm from California.
Okay. Listen, my wife and I moved to Bloomfield in May.
Mm-hmm.
And she was born in Astoria. I lived in Astoria 26 years. I got to say, the worst people in a group of people are New Jersey drivers.
I will agree with that. New Jersey drivers are pretty bad drivers.
They drive right up your butt.
I have experienced that, yes. The tailgating.
Expecting you to move out of the way.
The light jumping.
I can't believe it.
Yeah.
Until I moved here, I thought Massachusetts and New Hampshire drivers were terrible. They're better than New Jersey drivers.
We have terrible drivers here.
I just had an event. I just had to, because I just got off Route 3, and people are, you know, cutting me off without their blinkers. I'm not doing 30 miles an hour. I'm driving 55, 60 miles an hour.
I'll tell you something. I ride my bike a lot. I'm afraid to ride my bike in New Jersey. I'm happy to ride my bike in Manhattan.
I just had to get that. So, for me, it's been New Jersey drivers. I know my wife will agree, too. So, thank you, guys.
Okay, thanks for calling. Have a good one.
Have a good one.
Yeah. All you fellow New Jersey drivers, stop tailgating. Stop light jumping. It's scary and dangerous. That's why insurance rates are so high here.
FMU, you're on the radio.
Hey, guys. Hey, Frank. I'm assuming you're not going to use H-A-G-O.
H-H-G-O?
H-A-G-O. Text talk.
What's
I don't
H-A-G-O?
Know that one.
Have a good one.
Oh, we should.
That can be your tattoo.
Oh, I'm writing it down.
You can have it magically revealed.
Hey, go.
Along with your seafoam underwear.
I'm going to tattoo it on my butt.
Be your tramp stamp, right?
Yeah. Right above my butt. It's going to say H-A-G-O. Have a good one.
If it's going to be a tramp stamp, I just like spell it out
and
you just
know, want
script.
The whole thing?
Yeah, the whole thing. Why not?
Yeah, like this?
Yeah. And then on your around your ring finger, you can have H-A-G-O, something like that.
You're so romantic. So, Mister, what's the worst group of people in America?
I don't have one. That's all I had was H-A-G-O.
Oh, well, that was good enough. Love you.
That was worth
love
it.
You,
okay, have a good one.
Okay, we should come to a decision now. We're coming up
Charles
on the end of the show.
With internet trolls is my winner.
Well, YouTube trolls.
Yeah, YouTube. Fine. YouTube
okay.
trolls.
That
Charles, email me your address and t-shirt size at shutupweirdo@wfmu.org.
Is there anything
we're
else?
We're not here next week.
I think we're going to play a repeat.
But
because nobody wants to do the show with
me. When we come back in, what's the
date? 2 weeks from now.
November.
Well, 4 plus 14 18th. Would be the 18th.
We have an awesome topic.
We will have an awesome topic. We'll have two awesome
topics.
Should
we post it ahead of time?
We can do that, yes. We
okay,
can, like,
we'll post it.
Before next week's non-show, we'll post the awesome topic and get people time to like get their
yeah,
awesome
it is good.
Stories together.
Okay. All right, everyone. Thanks for listening.
You have been listening to Shut Up Weirdo here on WFMU. You can comment during the show at WFMU.org. We didn't say that enough during the show.
I said it a lot.
We mentioned the comments, but people
I said
don't
it
know.
A lot.
They don't know how to comment. You have to go to WFMU.org. Up next is, let me just double check. Up next is, I forgot now. Stuff You Should Know. I should know that. Stuff You Should Know is coming up next. Mr. Fine Wine is in at 8 o'clock. And I forget what comes after that. We have a website at shutupweirdo.com, which has links to our fabulous Facebook page. So much stuff going on there. Our Twitter and our tunes and all of our archives. If you missed the beginning of this show, for example. Now, I need to tell you that you are listening to The Merman, WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, live and archived at WFMU.org. Any last comments?
Let's end it here.
Yes, let's end it here.
It's time for Josh and Chuck and Stuff You Should Know, the program that exposes the internal workings of life on this planet. This is the radio version of the Stuff You Should Know podcast, which is available from HowStuffWorks.com. Tonight, Josh and Chuck discuss Typhoid Mary, as well as typhoid, and then in part two, they examine zoot suits and the culture that surrounded them. Now here's Josh and Chuck.
Hey, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Josh Clark. There's Charles W. Grinny Boy, Chuck Bryant.
And Jerry.
Yeah.
Back in his house.
Yep.
No more guest producing.
No.
That was a rough week.
Sure was.
But she's back.
Yeah. Hey, Jerry. Did you hear that, everybody? Probably not. Chuck.
Yes.
Jerry. Have you guys ever heard how much manure a horse produces in a day?
I'm glad you went with this. I was never really occurred to me. Go ahead.
25 pounds. 25 pounds of manure.
Did you do the math? Because I did.
Well, you come with that in a second, okay? So just go back with me a little bit, Chuck, to the time when Daniel Day-Lewis was walking around New York with a meat cleaver, overacting a little bit, in my opinion. it's the late 19th century. And the horse is the preferred mode of transportation for everything.
Sure.
From the most humble delivery cart to the greatest ambulance to, you know, people who like to ride horses, Three Musketeers, that kind of thing. Everybody had a horse.
To the limo, to the airport.
Wherever. So there were about 200,000 horses in New York City in use in 1895, right?
Yeah.
Multiply that times 25 pounds of poop a day, and what do you get, Chuck?
Well, I did 225,000 because I thought that was the number.
Okay, so that's fine. We'll go with that.
More than 6.2 million pounds of horse poop per day deposited on the streets of New York.
Okay. Now, let's say that's 1894.
Okay.
Okay? there's that many horses. There's 6.2 million pounds of horse poop every day.
That's a lot of poop.
It's a lot of poop, but not only that, there was no one cleaning it up.
Not enough people cleaning it up, let's say that for sure.
It was just left there, basically, in a lot of cases, to basically be ground into the cobblestone.
And, yeah.
You know, it makes you think, like, I'll bet there's a substantial layer of horse manure under the streets of New York that make up, like, that initial stratum of earth.
They call that the pooposphere, I think. Oh, wait, that would be in outer space.
No, because the lithosphere is part of it? Yes, so you were dead on.
Thank you.
The pooposphere. 1895, things changed a little bit. The New York institutes a Department of Health and a group of basically an army of cleaning guys, very much like the garbage man that Homer Simpson envisions in the garbage commissioner episode. I can't remember which one it is.
Yeah.
The Love Day episode is what it is.
Okay.
These guys, they're called White Wings. They are deployed to clean up the streets of New York, and they do a heck of a job.
Yeah.
And possibly the fact of the episode, if I may take it.
Please.
This is where the term cleanliness is next to godliness is coined.
Pretty cool.
The New York Department of Health slogan in 1895.
Downtown New York, Josh, at the turn of the century, back then, was a disgusting, filthy place.
And yet, I love New York.
I love the history of New York. We both watched the same Nova video on Typhoid Mary today, and they had photos of mountains of manure pushed to the sidewalks. And sort of like if you've ever been in New York on garbage day, imagine all those garbage bags as poop.
Yeah, but not poop in bags, just mounds of poop.
And they were dead animal carcasses. Did
dead
you see that
people,
one shot?
Probably.
It was like these boys playing in the street with just a dead horse right in the middle of their little stickball diamond. Yeah. I guess he was home base or something.
Yeah.
And it was just a foul, disgusting, unclean, unsanitary place, which, like you said, led to the formation of the Department of Sanitation.
Right. So the
Thank
Department
God.
Of, the Department of Sanitation was imbued with a lot of clout from
it's a
the get-go.
Problem.
Yeah. And as you said, the Nova documentary on Typhoid Mary, it's called like the most dangerous woman in America, I believe.
Yeah, I think so.
But it's also on YouTube under Typhoid Mary Nova.
Yeah, that's good.
It was. But they had a lot of clout. They could forcibly inoculate you with these newfangled inoculations. They could forcibly remove you to a quarantine island, and New York had a bunch of them.
Yeah, that was popular at the time.
Yeah, but basically your civil liberties could be entirely suspended without any sort of due process of law, and you were considered sick. And a lot of this was based on this new understanding of science, of germ theory, thanks to our buddy Louis Pasteur.
Bacteriology.
Yep. So the problem was science reporting hadn't been established yet. So all of the people who were in charge understood what was going on. They understood germ theory. They understood inoculations. They understood forced quarantine.
Mm-hmm.
But no one had explained it to the public fully.
Right.
So
it's a recipe for disaster.
Right. So there's this thing called typhoid. And apparently they were one and the same until the 19th century. About this time, typhus and typhoid fever, were separated. But typhoid fever, which is the star of this, co-star of this episode.
Sure.
It's particularly nasty, isn't it?
It is, Josh. We're talking not just ordinary diarrhea, but doubled over, cramping, painful diarrhea.
I think you'd call that violent diarrhea.
Violent diarrhea. High fever, red rashes, sleeplessness, death if you don't treat it.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people through history have been stricken with it, including Mary Todd Lincoln, Georgia O'Keeffe, Ravi Shankar.
Roy Cohn.
Frank McCourt, author, and Wilbur Wright, actually, of the Wright brothers fame, died from typhoid fever.
No way.
Yeah.
Wow.
Pretty sad. And that's a scant sampling from a long, long list of famous people that have.
Well, those are the people who count who had typhoid fever.
Yeah, I think Lincoln's son actually died from it as well, but I don't think Mary Todd Lincoln died from it.
Yeah.
But you can. It
no, she died of
gunshot
insanity
wound to the
head. Or something like that is what they would have called
oh,
it.
No, that was Abraham
or
Lincoln.
Hysterics, right.
Okay.
Nice. So before we started to get a handle on typhoid fever, it's caused by the bacterium Salmonella typhi.
Mm-hmm.
It's a type of Salmonella. And before we got a handle on it with antibiotics, apparently 12% of people died from typhoid. So it was a big public health problem.
Yeah, New York especially, there were 4,000 new cases per year and killed 1 in 10 people at the time.
Or 1 in 12%.
Okay.
However that goes.
Was that nationwide?
I understand it. Before antibiotics.
Gotcha.
So let's even just say 10%. That's a big public health problem. And because it's spread by the bacterium Salmonella, did that come out weird? Because it did in my head.
Slightly. A little bit of the lazy tongue there.
because it's spread through Salmonella, or because it's a result of Salmonella, it's very, very easily spread from handling your own poop, e.g. using the bathroom, not washing your hands, and then handling food. Uncooked food specifically.
Yeah.
It was normally considered to be like a disease of the lower classes.
Yeah.
Until 1906, was it, Chuck? The summer of 1906, in a wealthy quarter of the United States on Long Island called Oyster Bay.
Billy Joel's home, I believe. It's neither here nor there.
Okay. Still, that's one extra fact you just gave everybody.
That's true. When it happened in Oyster Bay, it was a much bigger deal because it was more closely associated with, let's say, the Lower East Side, mm-hmm. tenement housing, the filth of Lower Manhattan at the time. They've cleaned all that up now.
It is expensive.
What you get, though, when you're in Oyster Bay is you get wealthy families who can spend a little money, and that's what you had in the case of the Thompson family. They were afraid that they would not be able to rent out the house that they were living in because people were getting sick in that house over and over and over, and they couldn't figure it out. They decided to hire an investigator who turned out to be a very prominent figure in this case named Dr. George Soper, mm-hmm. a sanitation engineer and epidemiologist.
One of the first epidemiologists.
Really looking to make his career.
Well, he already had out. He had a reputation of you know, being able to track any illness back to its source. So this family, the Thompson family, is that the one who owned the house or the one who got sick?
They owned the house, and I believe some family members had also gotten sick.
Okay, so but there was a family that rented it originally, and that's where the typhoid outbreak first happened.
Oh, so maybe they were just the homeowners.
The Thompson family hired Soper, I believe.
Yeah, yeah.
And said, hey, we can't rent this house anymore because people are dying from typhoid.
Well, that was their concern.
Right, yeah. So Soper gets on the case, starts finds the family where the typhoid outbreak occurred, and starts interviewing the heck out of them. And he's stumped. He can't figure it out. Like, where did this thing come from? These are clearly patient zeros right here. Like, nobody else on Oyster Bay had it before then.
Right, right.
They didn't bring it with them from the city. There's somebody missing. There's something missing. And he finally says, have I talked to everybody who was in this house in the summer of 1906?
And they said, you should talk to Typhoid Mary.
Yeah.
I don't know why I didn't think of that.
And he goes, what?
No, what he did was he interviewed kitchen staff, and it turns out that there was a former employee that was no longer there, Mary Mallon.
Yeah.
And he said, wait a minute, you know, maybe I should check this lady out. Yeah. Turns out she loved to serve this ice cream and fresh peaches, mm-hmm. which is uncooked.
Right.
And that was her, I guess her, she was noted for that dessert.
Right. But even more incriminating than the dessert is the idea that when he looked into her history, she'd worked for 8 families in 10 years, and 6 of those families had had typhoid outbreaks.
Yeah.
So he began to think that there was something special about Mary Mallon, and that she was what's called a healthy carrier, meaning, and I'm just going to paraphrase this awesome way the Nova doc put it, mm-hmm. right? When you get typhoid fever, there's almost always a clear winner. If the bacteria wins, you die. And if your immune system wins, the bacteria dies. But there's sometimes where there's a stalemate where your immune system continues to function and you live, and the bacteria continues to live in your system, which means you're healthy, but you're also extremely contagious.
Yeah.
And that's what Soper came to believe Mary Mallon was.
So she was technically, she actually had typhoid fever, but her immune system was able to suppress all of it.
Right.
Except the killing of all the bacteria part.
Right. So
pretty cool.
Soper,
not cool, but interesting because this is brand new.
Yeah, and this guy's on the cutting edge of this kind of thinking.
Yeah, and he knew, like, potentially she could be the face of bacteriology. The first bacteriology lab had just set up in New York City, mm-hmm. and it was a burgeoning, not industry, but science. So he was like, man, this is really going to put me on the map if I can prove this, at least.
So he didn't have any training in science reporting either, though, did he?
He didn't have training in people skills,
no.
evidently, either.
He goes to her and he's like, I finally found you. I believe you're infected with typhoid, so I need samples of your stool, your urine, and your blood. By the way, my name is George Soper. Good to meet
yeah,
you.
And she's like, oh, no, you're not.
Yeah, so it's about this time that Mary Mallon.
Well, who is she? We should describe who she is, at least.
Oh, go ahead, Chuck.
Mary Mallon was Irish. Right. She, Irish, came over as a teenager by herself.
Mm-hmm.
She was born in the poorest town, county, in Ireland. And Ireland at that time, especially in the poorest county, not a great place to be.
No.
Also dirty, also lots of death and dying and filth and disease.
And she was born in 1869, so I think that's on the heels of the potato famine, if not still in the middle of it.
So she comes over as a teenager, lives with her aunt and her uncle who pass away, and then is basically on her own in New York. And by all accounts, as a result of how she grew up and then to being on her own in New York, she was very, very tough and fiery.
And independent and resourceful.
Like, had it been anyone else, this might not have gone down like this.
No, huh?
They picked, literally, not picked, but as it turns out, it sounds like she was the toughest, most obstinate, stubborn, fiery woman in New York City.
Right. And, but she was also good at what she did. She worked her way up in the domestic servant classes to the pinnacle of it. A cook in that era in the domestic, in domestic service.
And sort of manager of the kitchen staff.
Well, not just that. Almost the whole house, basically. The all of the servants, the cook was pretty much at the top, maybe tied with the butler, depending on the house. But she was a cook for all these families, and not just, you know, families that could afford a cook, but like very wealthy families.
Yeah. So she's doing really well for herself.
She was good at her job, but she took no guff from any man. And when Soper came and told her that he wanted her feces, she chased him off with a carving fork, supposedly. That's how Soper reported it.
Yeah. And, you know, we'll get into her specifics later, and she got a real bad rap, but at the time, there was, like you said, there was no understanding on the public's behalf of this. This whole healthy carrier is not even proven yet. So, I mean, what is she supposed to do? Just say, like, sure, I'll go with you, stranger.
Right.
Take my poop.
Right.
And put me in a quarantine.
Yeah.
So she fought it like she probably had every right to.
Right. Most
initially.
People, though, wouldn't normally, you know, brandish a carving fork on somebody, but again, it's lost to history whether she really did do that or not.
It's a good story.
So Soper takes off, and he's not one to let his career just kind of slip through his fingers. And he goes to the New York Commissioner of Health.
Herman Biggs.
So Biggs was, he was the first one. And he was the one who was like, oh, by the way, we can come into your house and forcibly inoculate you and your children if we want. And we will do that, too, if we think that it's in the interest of the public health. So Biggs was very sympathetic to Soper's description of the story of this crazy Irish woman who was just patient zero in more than one outbreak and basically needed to be dealt with.
Yeah.
So he ordered one of his caseworkers, a few cops, and an ambulance out to where Mary lived, a tenement.
Yeah, Josephine Baker was the inspector.
Not the dancer.
No, but she apparently was a pretty tough lady as well.
Oh, yeah. She started her own rainbow family.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, and, you know, we should also point out, one of the reasons that Mallon was so upset initially was that she got the feeling they were essentially calling her dirty and unsanitary.
Right, yeah.
Because he explained to her, like, oh, you go poop, and then you get poop in your hands, and you handle peaches that you feed people. And so she was very, she was upset that they felt like they were picking on her cleanliness.
Right.
Which,
she's like,
of course,
she's
gonna
just
be
a dirty Irish immigrant or something.
Yeah, exactly.
Like
they were, you know, dirty drunks and causing problems, and that was just the stereotype at the time. And she wasn't like that, she said.
Right. So Soper goes to Biggs. Biggs orders some people out. They use their power and grab Mary.
Well, she hides out in the house for a while, though.
Okay.
Like, it took 3 hours to find her.
Well, when they finally did, apparently it took either three or four cops to drag her to the ambulance. And then the female caseworker sat on her for the whole ride to this hospital, this quarantine hospital,
yeah,
where she was kept for a while. And like you said, it just happened to work out that the person who was Typhoid Mary was this very stubborn, obstinate, self-assertive woman, mm-hmm, from Ireland. And she came about at a time where there was a big question about public health. Like, you know, where do an individual's civil rights end, yeah, and public, the greater public good begin?
That's still going on.
It still is, but she forced this conversation into the national spotlight starting,
absolutely,
about now.
Yeah.
So they keep her, they test her. They're like, you need to poop into this bag right now.
Yeah.
And she did. And they tested it, and they said, well, this thing's lousy with typhoid. They
right,
called her stool a factory for typhoid.
Yeah. And what they did was they said, here's the deal. Give up cooking, because that's how you're transmitting this, and we'll let you go. And
so did they say that immediately? I caught that from the article, but not necessarily from the documentary.
I think they initially offered her that deal that she refused, which was one reason why she was, you know, lambasted in the public later on in newspapers. But again, at the time, she had managed to climb up out of the poor conditions that she was living in Ireland and, mm-hmm, get a really good job,
mm-hmm,
and one that she was good at. And she didn't want to have to learn something new and start over again. So at the time, you know, like later on, I can dole out some of the blame on her, but early on, she still feels well.
Right.
It's like, I'm not sick. This doesn't make any sense. What is this healthy carrier thing?
Yes. Yeah, she was not buying it at all.
No.
And she basically came to believe that the public health department had a vendetta against her personally and felt quite persecuted. So when she said no, she wasn't going to stop cooking, they said, okay, well, we're going to take you to a nice little island called North Brother Island.
It was not a nice island.
1907, they took her there and quarantined her there. North Brother Island is a, or it was a tuberculosis hospital quarantine
yeah,
hospital, I should say. And she didn't have tuberculosis, and she wasn't even sick. She didn't have any symptoms, and yet she was being kept here against her will on North Brother Island, which you sent a killer,
yeah,
urban exploration photo spread that I want everybody to go check out.
It's creepy.
It's on gothamist.com. And that's G-O-T-H-A-M-I-S-T. And it's titled A Trip to the Abandoned North Brother Island. It is so cool.
Yeah, located there was Riverside Hospital. And initially there was nothing there. And they said, hey, the idea of island quarantines was pretty popular at the time. So we should build a hospital there,
mm-hmm,
so we can treat these people. But North Brother Island sort of gained a reputation over the years because, one, it was much more than tuberculosis. It was like, later on, it was like heroin junkies were treated there, syphilis, like any kind of nasty disease or addiction, they would dump you on at Riverside Hospital.
It was an asylum.
It basically was. It was sort of like, what's the DiCaprio?
Shutter Island?
Shutter Island.
Yeah.
But they had a hard time staffing it with real doctors for a while because doctors understandably didn't want to work there. So they had nurses only for a time. Eventually, there was a public campaign to clean it up and to build better buildings and change its rep, which sort of worked, sort of didn't. But in New York City at the time, especially in the Lower East Side and where poor people lived, it had a very bad reputation as you don't want to go there because you go there and you don't come back.
Right.
People were afraid of it.
Right.
So that's where they send this Mary Malinoff to.
So, and when she gets there, she starts trying to get out. She hired a...
not escaping.
Right, no. Using legal channels.
Yeah.
She hired a private lab, and started sending them samples of her stool, and they were testing it, and they were not getting the same results.
Her boyfriend would sneak her poop,
yeah,
to the lab.
And they weren't getting the same results that the public health department said that they were getting, as far as her being a factory for typhoid.
Right, which could have been a false negative, right?
It could have been.
Because they said that you don't always... find it in the testing. Isn't that what they said in the documentary?
I believe so. But there was a discrepancy, and it was enough for her to get her day in court.
Yeah, New York Supreme Court.
So she makes her way. She's allowed to leave the island to go for her court date. And basically the public health department was like, look, she's a healthy carrier, and she's a public health threat.
Yeah.
And Mary's like, these people are holding me against my will. And the New York Supreme Court said, you're a public health threat. Go back to North Brother Island.
Yeah, and around the same time, it started getting newspaper coverage, courtesy of William Randolph Hearst.
Who may have financed her law.
That's crazy.
Her legal expenses.
I imagine it was great for the paper, so
yeah.
I could see him throwing a little money toward it.
Totally.
But that's where she was dubbed Typhoid Mary, and that's where the public sentiment really swung, because she was painted as someone who was willingly giving people typhoid fever.
Right. Well, no, she was
not
called
purposely.
Typhoid Mary because they were protecting her her identity as well.
That didn't work too well.
No. So Mary goes back to North Brother Island and is there for another... Well, she was there for 3 years total, I believe. And in the third year, New York City got a new health commissioner. And he was not about basically squashing people's civil rights.
Literally.
So he not only freed her, he got her a job.
Yeah, and a lot of people, while she was incarcerated, and it was an incarceration, I guess, there were a lot of people that did cry out for her release at times, public officials even.
Mm-hmm.
But the Department of Health, basically it was such a unique case, they wanted to experiment on her and said, no, we're going to do some tests on her and not let her out.
Well, they did do some tests on her. They thought that perhaps her gallbladder was the culprit.
Yeah.
So they were like, we're going to take your gallbladder out. And she's like, no, you're not.
Yeah, she's like, nobody's touching me.
She's afraid they're going to kill her.
Well, it could have too.
They did forcibly medicate her. They tried some stuff out, and she said that she wrote in a diary that if they keep this up for much longer, she'll surely die, because it's just the side effects were so horrid. So it wasn't just like, hey, stay in this cottage. There's a nice view of the water. It was rough for her, in addition to the civil liberties being squashed.
Exactly. And so, as you pointed out, the new commish comes in, literally, of public health, and a bit more sympathetic. Like you said, he found her a job in laundry, which apparently was the bottom of the barrel for a woman, a woman's career aspirations.
In domestic servant.
Like, no money,
quarters.
Like, the lowest pay, the worst work. And she was like, this sucks. I don't want to do this.
Right.
I don't want to work in the laundry.
Did you know that Atlanta has one of the taxi drivers in Atlanta is a Ghanese king?
No way.
That's what I thought of when I was reading about that, when she got a job in the laundry. And it's like, she worked her way past that. She's way past that.
Is he really?
There's a Ghanese king.
It's like Coming to America.
Who operates a cab here in Atlanta.
They ain't none but Ultra Perm.
Yeah, that was a good movie.
Dude, I could quote it from heart, I think. In full.
Let's start.
Okay. Bark like a dog. All right, so back to Mary. Where are we here? She's just been released, or he offered her the job, right?
Yeah, and she's out. And she's making
contact. After
3 years. Yeah, but she's making contact with the health department. They're like, we need to be able to keep up with you and make sure we know what you're doing and everything. And then they're like, we know where she is, we know what she's doing, we talk to her every day, and okay, we lost her.
Yeah, we don't know where she is anymore.
Yeah,
it's pretty cool at the time. You could disappear.
Yeah.
And if you don't leave a forwarding address, it's like, oh well,
yeah,
no Google searching going on there.
You could disappear into the folds of Daniel Day-Lewis's overacting.
So a few years after this, Josh, after they had lost her, Dr. Soper's brought in again to investigate another typhoid outbreak at the upscale hospital, Sloan Hospital. And I think it was a baby birthing hospital at the time.
Yeah.
Maternity hospital.
Yeah.
And what they discovered was Mary was cooking in the kitchen at the hospital.
Yeah, under an assumed name.
25 doctors and nurses were sick, and I believe two of them died. And they said, you know, you're in big trouble this time.
Yeah, but not only did they discover it, was Soper himself was called into the case.
This is like Les Miserables.
And exactly, it is very much like that. And he comes to the hospital, and he recognizes Mary by sight as one of the cooking staff, and is like, you are kidding me.
She's whipping up her ice cream and peaches.
And just stops, like, yeah. Mid-stroke, like,
she's got poop on her hands.
This is awkward. So... this time she goes willingly. She knows that it's over. It's done. She still doesn't believe that she is a carrier or the problem,
mm-hmm.
but she knows that they think she is, and that she's broken some sort of horrendous law somehow.
It was kind of sad at that point, from the way it was described in the documentary. She was just sort of like, I mean, all the fight of this fiery woman was gone. And yeah. She's just like, I just can't fight this anymore. Take me.
And part of it also, I imagine, was public opinion turned against her. Like you said, the first time she was incarcerated at North Brother Island, there was a lot of public outcry. This time, there's a lot of public outcry, but it was against her because she had willfully and knowingly gone back into cooking and had gotten more people sick.
Yeah.
Like, I think 50-something cases were attributed to her and three deaths.
Yeah, I think 49 to 52 is what I read. And you know, we got to say, like, I'm defending her in a lot of ways, but they gave her a few pretty good deals along the way that she did not take, which was A, to give up cooking. B, I think at one point they said, why don't you just move to Connecticut with your sister? And she was like, I don't have a sister. And they were like, sure you do, Jane.
Yeah. She's like, wait, are you having a stroke?
Exactly. So she didn't take him up on that offer. And Soper promised her 100% of the profits of a book that he would write about her and about the situation. And she was like, no.
Yeah.
No, no, no.
And wasn't that weird? Anthony Bourdain is one of the experts in that Nova documentary.
Yeah, I thought, a little odd.
Yeah.
I guess he knows his Typhoid Mary.
Yeah. He lives on Oyster Bay, I guess.
With Billy Joel.
So the legacy of Typhoid Mary is this great debate over how much civil liberty, how many civil rights does a person get to keep when they pose some sort of public health threat? And I guess the answer to that is contagion.
Yes.
Have you seen it?
I have not. You did the other night, right?
Yeah,
was it good?
I like it.
Was it frightening?
No, it was definitely, like, I don't... My back was tense the whole time.
Yeah.
It wasn't frightening, but it was good.
There was a really good editorial piece, too, that I read. I sent you where basically this could have gone down in so many different ways. It was sort of like the perfect storm of headstrong woman, health guy that didn't have a lot of people skills. They said his opinion was if that initial meeting had have gone down differently, the whole history might be rewritten. But it went down as them butting heads and just got worse from there.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty interesting.
Yeah.
So Typhoid Mary, was she a bad person, Josh?
Oh, I can't. I reserve judgment on historical figures.
Okay.
I don't know enough about them. Yeah, I think you can only judge your contemporaries, really.
All right. What about me?
I reserve judgment on
podcasters.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, if you want to know more about Typhoid Mary, you can watch Nova's excellent documentary, The Most Dangerous Woman in America. If you want to know the origin of the word quarantine, you should go back and listen to our Black Death episode. But if you haven't heard it before and you've read 1491, don't bother emailing in. I know already. I know. I'm sorry.
That was the Stuff You Should Know episode called The Wind Cries Typhoid Mary, originally podcast at HowStuffWorks.com on October 13th, 2011. This is the radio version of the Stuff You Should Know podcast. Now for part two, Josh and Chuck examine zoot suits. This episode was originally podcast on October 11th, 2011.
Hey, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Josh Clark. There's Charles W. Chuckers Bryant. And since the two of us are sitting together again... and it's not lunchtime.
It's not leg wrestling time.
That's true. This means it's Stuff You Should Know.
Right.
Yeah. What's up, dude?
How are you, Josh?
I'm good. We just got something in today that I want to give a shout out of thanks for.
Oh, yeah?
To our friend Martin Van Nostrand.
Did that come in today?
Today.
Okay.
He kept emailing us, pestering me, like, has it not come yet? like I'm the Postmaster General or something like that.
Right.
But anyway, he sent us each a t-shirt and the new CD of his band, The Bangalores.
Yeah.
In Vitro Meat is the name of the album. And it's pretty awesome.
I haven't listened to it yet. I just got it. Can't wait.
He sent us some songs off of it already.
Oh, some previous cuts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He was the first person to record a Stuff You Should Know song, like, in 2008. You remember?
Well, yeah, and I think he has a toxoplasmosis song on the new one, right?
He does. Yeah, we've inspired a lot. I think he released a whole album of Stuff You Should Know songs.
Really?
Yeah, and like quick little punk songs too, like a minute and a half, so there's like 50 of them.
Yeah.
But anyway, thanks a lot to Van Nostrand.
We won't say his real name, but we know it.
We do, finally. We didn't for a long time. But anyway, if you feel like checking that out, it's The Bangalores, like the city in India, and the album is In Vitro Meat. And we'll probably get in trouble for endorsing this.
Probably so.
So, Chuck, you want to get to it?
Yes.
Have you ever heard of some dumb laws?
Yeah, man.
There are some dumb laws in this great land of ours. For example, if I may, I've prepared a short list.
Awesome.
In Alabama, bear wrestling matches are prohibited. It's illegal to sell peanuts in Lee County after sundown on Wednesday. That would be Lee County, Alabama.
Did it give a reason for that one?
No, there are some. This is from, I think, dumblaws.com. And they have, like, just international laws, state laws,
right.
Local laws. And then under some of them, they have, like, full text of the law or why this law exists.
Gotcha. So
it's a pretty comprehensive site. In Hawaii, coins are not allowed to be placed in one's ears. They're for spending only.
Okay.
All residents may be fined as a result of not owning a boat.
You're going to Hawaii tomorrow, right? Or in the next couple of days.
Yeah.
I dare you to put a coin in your ear and walk around eating out of a can
of
spam.
And be like, I don't own a boat. I don't own a boat.
Right.
Chumps. Back in our fair state of Georgia, to legally use profanity in front of a dead body, which lies in a funeral home or in a coroner's office.
That's respectful. That's a good law.
Okay. In Ackworth, which is close to Kennesaw, where I grew up, where had to own a gun.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know this. In Ackworth, all citizens must own a rake.
Really?
Yeah.
Not a blower.
A rake.
Okay.
I think a blower, that's kind of like asking a lot of some of the lower income classes,
sure.
You know. In Athens, on Mondays, it's illegal for one to whistle very loudly after 11 p.m.
What?
But on Mondays.
Okay.
And then California, of course, is going to have some zany laws. They have tons and tons of wacky, dumb laws. Animals are banned from mating publicly within 1,500 feet of a tavern, school, or place of worship.
I agree.
Women may not drive in a house coat.
I agree with that, too.
In Fresno, getting drunk in a playground is against the law. That is sound.
I don't agree with that one.
It's sensible. And then in Los Angeles, it's illegal to wear a zoot suit.
Yeah, still?
Still.
Wow.
So I bring that up, and I knew Chuck would like that last one, because I'm sure there's stories behind almost all of those zany laws, or at least there's some reasoning. People don't just make up crazy laws. Like bear wrestling, I'm sure it got out of hand once, and now they're just like, that's it, it's illegal.
Right.
So Chuck and I actually know the reason why zoot suits are illegal in Los Angeles County, California, and
that's
we're
right.
going to tell you about it today.
It's pretty neat. This little article started off as a bit of a lark? I don't know. Well, we thought zoot suits, those are interesting and cool, but it's more than a suit, as it turns out.
It really is.
It was, at least.
You should probably mention, like, what is a zoot suit, Chuck?
A zoot suit.
I think everybody's seen them before.
Yeah, back in the 1930s, they were very much in fashion, especially in Latino communities and African-American communities.
Mm-hmm.
Coast to coast, though.
Yeah.
Seems like. Cesar Chavez, Malcolm X, Cab Calloway, big band leaders, the jazz scene in New York, all very much associated with zoot suits.
Tom Cat from Tom and Jerry.
Yeah.
Who was going after a girl, and she said he was a square and was corny, and he goes out and gets him a zoot suit and becomes a cool cat.
A cool cat.
Yeah.
So you'll know a zoot suit. They were originally worn made of wool and then later rayon, but you'll know it because they're very distinct. They have very broad padded shoulders, very long-waisted coats. The suit pants were worn really, really high, like up over the belly. And were very tight at the top, then ballooned out like MC Hammer style.
Right.
And then tapered back down again at the ankle.
Or were pegged.
Oh, well, of course.
Yeah.
That's how you achieve that look.
Right.
And the jackets, exaggerated contours and colors. A lot of times they would wear the big pocket watch chain that went down to their knee, mm-hmm. and the hat with the feather. And it was
pointy
just
shoes.
Like pointed shoes, sure.
So they, if it sounds a lot like pimps... 70s pimps wear to you.
Not too far off, I guess.
I think you could make an argument that it was a predecessor of that. And in fact, you mentioned Malcolm X favored zoot suits. I didn't realize this today, but in researching zoot suits, Malcolm X used to be called Detroit Red, who was in fact a pimp.
Yeah.
And he apparently got his education in Harlem and became Malcolm X.
Did you not see the movie?
No, I haven't.
It was good. From what I remember from the awesome Spike Lee movie was that he was... into the zoot scene earlier, and then once he, you know, became Malcolm X and not, what was his original name, Shabazz?
Yes, I believe so.
Malcolm Shabazz.
Yeah.
So once he became Malcolm X and got serious about civil rights, he ditched the zoot suit and stuff and was a little more traditionally garbed.
Right. Another way, so the zoot suit, you just nailed it on the head. You said the zoot suit scene. It was very much part of a scene, part of the Harlem Renaissance. It was part of the Pacho scene out in Los Angeles, which we'll talk about.
Pacho?
Pacho.
Pachuco?
Pachuco. I like slang on top of slang, so yeah. I call it Pacho.
Exactly.
So it was kind of the uniform of this certain kind of scene. Mm-hmm. Apparently the upscale black nightclubs of Harlem, like if you saw an African-American man walking around wearing a zoot suit, you're like, that guy is a high roller, and he knows how to get into the good clubs.
I thought you were going to bust out some Cab Calloway slang.
Well, you mentioned Cab Calloway was one of the people who loved zoot suits, and he wrote a dictionary of slang.
Mm-hmm. A
jive slang. Thank you.
Yeah.
I could not be square if I tried. and one of the words that he put down was zoot, which he says means exaggerated.
Okay.
It turns out that there's a whole lot of mystery surrounding the origins of zoot suit. But if I may, in Cab Calloway's jive slang, describe what a zoot suit looks like. You did a great job.
Please,
in normal, square, corny terms. But if you want to talk like a hep cat from the jive jump zoot suit era, you would describe it as a killer diller coat with a drape shape, real pleats, and shoulders padded like a lunatic cell.
Well, it's interesting that he said drape, because originally they were known as drape suits and even advertised as extreme, quote, extreme drapes,
right,
in newspapers.
Yeah.
Pretty cool.
Yeah. So zoot suit's hanging out there. It's kind of weird. Ralph Ellison wrote about it in his Invisible Man, his novel. The narrator encounters three young and extravagantly dressed blacks in their zoot suits. And he says that they were the stewards of something uncomfortable. So he's saying, like, there's just, it's almost like it was, it's the same as if you saw a bunch of rave kids wearing, like,
those stupid pants.
Yes, in the 90s or whatever, yeah. You know, or hip hop kids today. It was the same thing, except this was much more upscale.
Right.
Than that. But
like
it was basically
the baggy,
like,
pants today.
Yeah.
That people have trouble walking in, but they're still got to have that look, you know.
Right.
Because that's what the cool kids do.
Exactly. So this was, you could argue, the original American version of counterculture dress.
Right. Agreed.
And it grew out of Harlem and was later adopted by Mexican-Americans or Latino-Americans in Los Angeles.
Yeah, what's this one bit that it could have originated in Gainesville, Georgia? How about that?
So, there's some origin stories, right?
And none of them are the same, right? And they're all very different.
No, but I do like that one you're talking about from Gainesville. What is it?
Yeah, a bus worker named Clyde Duncan from New York came back to New York with one and said he bought it in Gainesville, Georgia. And allegedly, he had been inspired by Gone with the Wind and wanted to look like Rhett Butler.
Right.
And so got a tailor in Gainesville to make him this thing. I'd like to go with that story.
Well, the New York Times put that story forth, and they said it basically unequivocally.
They did.
In 1943. And that was the story for many, many years until historians actually started to put real effort and thought into the zoot suits. And they found that it's possibly true, but most likely it came out of either guys like Cab Calloway wearing them.
Sure.
Or guys like Cab Calloway copying people in the jazz scene.
Right.
And then, you know, it basically going forth like that. And ultimately, it seems that it did come out of this era, whether it was this Clyde Duncan fella,
right,
who had the idea originally or whatever. You can basically say the Harlem Renaissance, zoot suits came out of that.
Gotcha. And, you know, I knew that. I did not know of its association within the Latino and largely Mexican community.
No, but that's where it, like, really started to... It switched when it hit the Latino American community. Before, it was just like, I'm wealthy, I can get into good clubs, I'm part of this club scene in Harlem. When it hit Los Angeles and was taken up by the Pachos.
Pachucos.
Right? Square.
Uh-huh.
It changed. It transformed. It turned into something political and became ultimately a sign of defiance.
Yeah, in World War II, you know, everyone knows that there was rationing going on, everything from food to metals and ultimately wool and cloth. So wearing a zoot suit, which required an abundance of cloth, was deemed not patriotic.
Right.
Because you're basically flaunting, hey, I don't care about the war effort. I'm going to wear my zoot suit. That's more important to me.
Right, exactly. So in the 40s, the War Production Board basically said, we need to cut back all fabric use in the States by 26%. And to help you, here is the new American suit. It's streamlined. It uses less fabric. As long as you're making stuff according to these sketches, you're patriotic, you're American, you're within the law, right?
Uncle Sam wanted you to wear tight clothes.
Pretty much. And if you think about it, if you look at the suits in the 50s and 60s, and after the 40s, the classic American suit is narrow.
Yeah.
It's narrow cut. The cuffs are high.
Skinny ties.
Yeah. So I wonder if that came out of that. I'm sure it did.
I bet it did.
But you can take what they were saying a different way, and that Uncle Sam's telling you to dress like this, and everybody dress like that.
Yeah.
So zoot suits immediately became a symbol of defiance. Anybody who wore them was saying, you know, up yours, Uncle Sam. And it was ultimately illegal to manufacture or advertise a zoot suit or anything that fell outside of those American suits. So, incredibly, bootleg and underground tailors grew up to make and sell zoot suits.
That's true.
Yeah.
And at the same time, especially in Los Angeles, it had an association with gang activity, criminal activity, and thuggery, largely because of newspapers that would call them, you know, zoot suiters committing crimes. They would, you know, label people in a particular clothing as being criminals, essentially.
Yeah, well, racism is definitely nothing new in this country, and it was hot and heavy in the late 30s, early 40s in Los Angeles.
Oh, yeah.
Among it was mainly targeted, I think, toward Latino Americans, but it's not like African Americans didn't get the brunt of it as well.
Sure.
But basically, it was white people in California were like, hey, there's a lot of you these days, so you're making us a little nervous, and you wearing the zoot suit is easy to target. It just so happened that the group that they were targeting was actually kind of homogenous. People who wore zoot suits kind of wore them in defiance, but also identified themselves with them, right? The pachos.
Yeah, it was a statement of independence, not necessarily thumbing your nose at the United States, but just, hey, I'm independent, I'm Latino, I'm living in Los Angeles, it's 1940s, and this is our look.
So the pachos?
But, yeah.
The pachucos?
Pachucos.
The pachos. I'm seeing pachos right here. Octavio Paz said pachos.
Did
pachos,
he?
Yeah.
Okay.
So the pachos were... they weren't an import from Mexico. They were a real American hybrid. They were second-generation Latino-American kids who, ironically, because of the war effort, were latchkey kids. Their parents were off working the night shift for war production, and they were basically left to their own devices. They called themselves 24-hour orphans, the first latchkey kids. And they were also arguably the first rebels. And out of their emergence in America came the whole concept of juvenile delinquency.
Yeah, I love that one quote from Octavio Paz. Can I read that?
Yeah.
He said the zoot suit was a symbol of love and joy or horror and loathing, an embodiment of liberty, of disorder, of the forbidden. So it was this single fashion item was at the same time asserting your independence and individuality as well as what white folks saw as thumbing their nose at the white man, basically.
Right. Yeah. And I guess that's exactly what they were doing because, as you said, like they weren't necessarily wearing the zoot suit as a statement. They weren't anti-war protesters.
Right.
But it was more like, you know what? I'm sick of you racist white people, and I'm not going to hide my identity. I'm not going to try to blend in.
Right.
I'm not going to go back to my traditional roots from Mexico because I wasn't born here.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not going to, you know, join the service and wear an American suit. So this was the compromise. And it ticked white people off like crazy.
Yeah, and
especially in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
Well, at the time, in Southern California, there was an enormous presence of servicemen,
sure,
who were waiting to ship out to the Pacific Theater from California.
Yeah, and they were, you know, rubbing elbows with these guys that a lot of people thought were gang members and zoot suiters, and they rubbed elbows not in a very good way either, which, you know, ultimately led to the Zoot Suit Riots, but there were some pretty striking events that led up to that 1943 summer.
So one of the things you said, you mentioned, was that they were getting negative press, right? So people in zoot suits were associated with things like, quote, the record already reveals killings, stabbings, and cases of innocent women having been molested by zoot suit gangsters. That's from the Los Angeles Examiner, and the article was titled, Police Must Clean Up L.A. Hoodlumism, which is not a word.
Hoodlumism?
Right. But so there's this joint effort of just general racism among whites in the general public, and servicemen waiting to be deployed specifically, and the Los Angeles media kind of fanning the flames.
That's right.
And then the Sleepy Lagoon murder happened.
The Sleepy Lagoon case. Sleepy Lagoon, Josh, was the reservoir by the L.A. River.
And that's not there anymore. Isn't that fascinating?
Yeah, not there at all.
There's like a plastics plant there now.
Yeah.
There's no reservoir.
Yeah, so don't go looking for it, even though they said it's roughly, was it 5500 Slauson Boulevard in Maywood? I know where that is, actually. I think it's on the way to the airport. So the Sleepy Lagoon case. At the time, Mexican-Americans were denied access to public pools and swimming holes and stuff like that, so they used Sleepy Lagoon as a big hangout where they would go and listen to music and swim and have a good time. In August 2, 1942, the body of Jose Diaz was found at this reservoir, and from what I gather, there was a big party, like a big house party, where a fight broke out.
Mm-hmm.
And one guy ended up getting killed, and as a result they rounded up 300 to 400 Mexican-American youths, had a corrupt trial where they basically denied them any civil rights, cooked up evidence, had no physical evidence, had no witnesses, nothing of the sort, and they basically pinned that murder on 12 guys, is that right?
Nine kids.
Nine
but
kids,
they rounded
12
up
total?
300.
Yeah.
But they railroaded nine with no evidence that the guy had even been murdered.
And eventually, the Sleepy Lagoon Defense Committee and the U.S. District Court of Appeals overturned that as a miscarriage of justice.
Right, but the damage was already done.
Yeah, and his killer, incidentally, was never found. They never singled anyone out.
Right.
Which is sad. That's kind of lost a lot of times, I think. But at the same time, you can't just cook up a case against dudes that were there.
Right.
And say that they did it.
Exactly. So the press attention that the Sleepy Lagoon case received just fanned the flames further and further. May of 1943.
Yeah.
That's when things really started to take a turn for the worse.
That's right.
I guess about a dozen servicemen, I think Navy boys, were down in East L.A.
Yeah.
And a few of them approached some girls. One of them kept walking. And the one that kept walking passed a group of pachos who were wearing zoot suits.
Pachucos.
And when he passed, one of them apparently raised his hand in what the guy took as a threatening manner.
Uh-huh.
So the serviceman grabbed his arm. And right after that, everything went black because somebody knocked him over the back of his head with something.
Yep.
And he fell and broke his jaw in two places. Okay?
The other guys see this.
The other guys see it, but yeah, before they even react, the pachos jump them. And these 11 other servicemen fight their way out.
Yeah.
And fight their way over to where the guy is laying, the guy who's knocked out with the broken jaw.
Yeah, and get him out of there,
and
right?
Get him out of there.
Yeah.
So this is not bode well for Mexican-American white relations in Los Angeles in 1943. A few days after that, like, revenge is on the mind of everybody after news of this gets out.
Yeah, big time, especially in the military community. And basically, sort of the same thing happened. Main Street, East L.A. on June 3rd, 11 sailors got off a bus, and there were words with a gang of young Mexicans. And when I say gang, I should say group.
And we shouldn't say necessarily Mexicans. The likelihood was that they were Mexican back in
confirmed?
The 40s, but they were Latino Americans.
Okay. I tried to get to the whole bottom of the word Chicano as well.
I know Hispanic is from Ronald Reagan.
Is it?
And it's basically, it insinuates that everybody from Central or Latin America or South America comes from Hispaniola.
Well, and what I found from Chicano was that it was a derogatory term early on, very negative, mm-hmm. but it meant specifically Mexican American. And then later, I believe they, some of them chose to embrace that word
yeah, in the
as
70s,
a point of pride. Yeah.
Or 60s?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting. I don't know where it stands today. So
let's just leave that
I'm
one alone.
I'm just not going to say it. So they ran into this group of young Latinos dressed in zoot suits, got in an argument. The sailors, of course, claimed that they were jumped, although it's unclear exactly how it started. And the LAPD responded, and with a group of off-duty officers and on-duty officers calling themselves the Vengeance Squad. And they basically took it upon themselves to clean up the streets of East L.A.
So the cops.
Roughhouse style.
The cops, yeah. Including off-duty cops, took on the name the Vengeance Squad and went down to the Latin American quarters, Latino American quarters, and just started beating people up.
Yeah, and this really, really set off what would be known as the Zoot Suit Riots. The next day on June 4th, about 200 U.S. Navy servicemen jumped in a bunch of taxis, went to East L.A.
And caravan.
Yeah, in a caravan, like a mob, essentially.
Yeah.
And started beating up Mexican kids, 12
Everybody.
And 13-year-old boys, clubbing them, stripping them of their clothes, burning their clothes.
That was the first group they encountered. And a bunch of adults tried to intervene. They got clubbed, too. Then after that, it wasn't just people wearing zoot suits. It was any Latino American that they saw.
Yeah.
They stormed movie theaters. They stormed bars. They stormed, like, any
Yeah, they pulled them businesses. Off of streetcars.
Yeah, and black guys got caught up in it, too.
Yeah, there was spread over
there
to
was
Watts.
An African-American guy mm-hmm. On the streetcar in, I think it was in Watts, who was pulled off and beaten to a pulp by servicemen just because he happened to be sitting there and was black. It was literally a riot, and it was perpetrated by white servicemen.
For several days, it was known as the Zoot Suit Riots. Cops were there, but they had orders to not arrest any of the servicemen.
Right.
So they were kind of given carte blanche for a few days.
So for a few days. Finally, the Los Angeles City Council comes to its senses and bans the presence of any servicemen in that area of Los Angeles and issues an ordinance whereby zoot suits are prohibited.
And in the end, 150 people were injured in the riots. Police arrested more than 500 Latinos mm-hmm. on charges ranging from rioting to vagrancy.
Yeah.
And I don't know if any servicemen were arrested.
I think a bagel number Zero. Of servicemen is probably a good guess.
I couldn't find any. Let's not say it didn't happen, but my feeling is it was probably zero.
Yeah.
And they... You know, the local press got a hold of this and called it a, quote, cleansing effect and said it was a pretty great thing going on in the city, when in fact it was one of the darkest days of Los Angeles in their history. Pretty sad.
It is. It's a pretty sad and strange story.
Yeah. Is there anything else to this?
No, I don't. The aftermath is...
I'll tell you, one interesting thing from the article was that... years later, young Russian Soviet teenagers would wear zoot suits.
Oh, yeah.
As an act of defiance.
Against communism.
Against communism.
Yeah.
So this article of clothing, this fashion statement, was a lot more than that. It's pretty interesting.
And this is one of those weird moments in history where it's not just like, did you know the zoot suit caused this riot? And then you find out that it didn't really.
Right.
This genuinely started it.
Yeah.
This was part of this made the pouchos. Easily identified targets. The whole reason they were wearing it was out of defiance, and it just irked the establishment. Like, the zoot suit caused these riots. It's crazy.
It is crazy.
And it had another lasting legacy, if I may.
Sure.
It juvenile delinquency, the whole concept of that coming out of this area and this era, mm-hmm. I believe gave rise to a slew of great movies. Rebel Without a Cause.
Sure.
The Wild Ones.
Oh, yeah.
And, if I may, mm-hmm. I Was a Teenage Werewolf, starring Michael Landon, who was a character saddled with a terrible affliction of throwing milk. So there's this little clip I would like to say.
Okay.
I pulled you out of fight 3 times myself in the last month. You're just lucky there weren't any formal complaints. The time before this in the supermarket.
It was the checker's mistake.
Yeah, but you didn't even give him a chance to rectify it. Boom, you throw a carton of milk right at him.
It contained bovine growth hormone, and he turned into a giant cow.
So that was the Mystery Science Theater 3000 take of Michael Landon.
Of course.
And his milk throwing problem.
Awesome.
Which probably wouldn't have existed had Zoot Suits not come about.
I'd never heard of that movie.
I Was a Teenage Werewolf?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I wonder if they picked him because of his huge mound of hair.
Maybe. Because he did look kind of werewolfy right out of the gate.
He was close.
Yeah. Even without the Mystery Science Theater 3000 guys discussing it, I guess.
It's just fun to watch.
It is. It's kind of a cool movie.
Yeah, look for a podcast on the Stonewall Riots. We're going to cover that soon, too. That's another overlooked blight of American history.
Yes.
We like to point these out.
If you want to learn more about all the stuff we talked about, like Cab Calloway's Jive Dictionary, you should search for that on your favorite search engine.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah, you could also search for Zoot Suit Smithsonian. That'll bring up a pretty cool article from, I think, like 1984. It's pretty comprehensive. And then, of course, the article on our own beloved site is excellent as well. You can type in Zoot Suits, Z-O-O-T space S-U-I-T-S. If you haven't known what we've been talking about this entire time, you want to type that into the search bar at howstuffworks.com. And since I said search bar, friends, neighbors, it is time for listener mail.
You know, some of that jive, Cab Calloway jazz jive, is still like a few of those words I recognize is still being used. It's kind of cool.
Oh, yeah, he established a lot of them.
Like, I'm not nearly cool enough to speak like this on a regular basis, but that's all I want in life, really.
Like, corny came from this era.
Really?
Groovy.
Okay. I say groovy a lot.
Moo juice for milk.
Never heard that.
You've not heard that?
No.
There's Buddy G as a guy. Like, thanks, Buddy G.
I've heard that.
But it's G-H-E-E.
Oh, okay.
Crumb crushers for teeth.
Nice.
Freebie. No charge.
Really?
Gratis, free. That came from there. So give me some skin.
Yeah,
shake hands. It all came out of this era.
Pretty
cool. Yeah, and we would not have one of the better parts of the movie Airplane.
Yeah.
If Cab Calloway and his cronies hadn't come up with this.
Man, I wish I had one cell of my body that was as cool as Cab Calloway was.
He was a cool dude. You know, Minnie the Moocher, like, has a lot of drug references in it.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Smokey is Cokey. He liked cocaine, and they talk about kicking the gong around, which apparently is smoking opium. And Minnie, actually, in the extended version, is taken to an asylum where she dies. And that's why the song ends with poor men,
really?
Poor men, poor men.
That was the Stuff You Should Know episode called A Podcast on Zoot Suits. Yes. Originally podcast at howstuffworks.com on October 11th, 2011. If you'd like to contact Josh or Chuck, you can email them at stuffpodcast@howstuffworks.com. You can subscribe to Stuff You Should Know and other podcasts at howstuffworks.com as well as on iTunes. This is WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, and online at WFMU.org.
Take off your big stones, put on your soul. Got that soul. downtown Soulville show, WFMU, trying to overcome some technical difficulties here. I think I've got it all straightened out, though, which will enable me to play an hour's worth of Soul 45s for you after all. I wasn't sure I was going to be able to. Here are the Tenderfoots.
That's all right, 'cause you know I'll understand. Yeah, yes, when you hold me, hold me tight. Girl, when you squeeze me, that's all right, 'cause I'm yours, yeah, yours. Anyhow, talk to me, baby, 'cause I love you so. Walk with me, baby, and I'll never let you go. Will now thrill, baby, squeeze me with all your might. Keep on thrilling me, baby, and I'll always treat you right.
Well, will you hold me? That's all right. Hold my hand, that's all right, 'cause you know I understand. Yeah, yes, when you hold me, hold me tight. Yeah, when you squeeze me, that's all right, 'cause I'm yours. Yeah, 'cause I'm yours.
Don't forget.
I ain't.